Good morning. It is 9:37, Wednesday, April 1st. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And I think for this year, we can stop doing April Fool's jokes. Actually, for every year, let's stop doing April Fool's jokes. They suck. I hate them.
And good morning, everybody. And I agree, no time for April Fool's jokes. Welcome to our podcast in the coronavirus world.
Jonathan Green, general manager for DJ Stable, and I haven't worn a real pair of pants in almost 3 weeks.
Ryan Diodonato, racing editor at the TDN and managing partner of Franklin Ave Equine, and I was clean shaven when this whole thing started.
I like they have like the March 1st to March 31st comparisons. We all look exactly the same, except John. Yeah, I'm significantly older now. Still not wearing pants, though. We had a thing last week where John said he looks like the love child of John Oliver and Jimmy Kimmel. So we're gonna run with that now. Appreciate that, John. There you go. They just changed to Jimmy Kimmel. Now he's back to John Oliver. All right.
Now we can talk with a regular accent, and then I have to go with an English accent.
Cool.
See, it sounded more Irish there, though. But we'll go. We'll work on that.
All right. So before we get into the whole nightmare of coronavirus world and how it's affecting us and racing and our livelihoods, we did have a really good weekend of racing, really good Saturday of racing at Gulfstream Park, and thought we should just run that down first, the Florida Derby, you know, maybe the last big three-year-old race for months. I know the Arkansas Derby has been pushed back a couple of weeks, so we'll still count on that running. But in general, I think this is probably going to be it for a while for big three-year-old racing. And I think the horse that won kind of sent us out with a bang. Bill and I are going to talk to Jack Knowlton of Sacatoga Stable later on. And my question about him going into the race, I expressed concern last week that in all of his wins, he had basically gotten the same trip, which was to settle and make one run out in the clear. And he proven to be pretty brilliant, but he had also gotten away with some pretty easy trips. This time, I think he showed an entirely different dimension, which makes me like him even more, is that he made his own trip, is that he was able to press the pace three wide. The pace was pretty quick, and he didn't need to get that inside-outside pocket trip. He made his own trip, and I think that's the thing that can take three-year-olds to the next level, is that kind of versatility where you don't have to rely on the dynamics of the race. You can create your own dynamics, and it seemed like the outcome was really never in doubt with the way he was traveling. Happy for Manny Franco, who's been a really good rider in New York for a long time and hasn't really, I don't think, had that big, big horse. He's had some big wins. He had his first Breeders' Cup win aboard Sharing last year, but happy for him, happy for Barkley Tag and the local crew, New York bred, so I'm always happy for those horses. And I just think Tis the Law is the kind of horse that you really want this time of the year. Only problem is now this time of the year isn't Derby time. Bill?
Yeah, absolutely agree on virtually every point. This is a horse that you can't poke any holes in him. I mean, where would you go to try to say he's vulnerable? He's got the breeding to go a mile and a quarter. He obviously has the ability. I mean, he's reeled off two grade one wins now in the Champaign and the Florida Derby, not to mention the Holy Bull before that. His speed figures are fine. You know, it's not like he's running 83 buyer numbers to win these races. And, you know, if the Kentucky Derby were coming up in 4+ weeks right now, you know, would he be the favorite? Probably not, because of whomever Bob Baffert in a normal world would be sending and be his big horse. Might overshadow him because of the Baffert factor, but he's clearly outside of the big horses in one barn of Baffert, easily the best horse in the country. And, you know, it's just going to be very interesting to see how do they piece this together between now and when the Kentucky Derby is run. The only thing we know is they're not running in the Arkansas Derby. They've ruled that out. But I've been a fan of this horse from day one, and I continue to be a fan of him. I really want to see what he can do down the road. And it's a long way to the Kentucky Derby, but he's my number one.
Well, and there's no reason why he shouldn't be the number one choice right now. You know, he put in such a huge effort in the Florida Derby, as you guys have mentioned, the way his running style lent itself. He's got tactical speed. He can sit off it. And basically, that's the kind of race quality that you look for in a young horse, is that they have a little versatility. They don't have to be in front. They don't have to come for a mile out of it. He's got tactical speed. He just keeps going. It's almost like he has a high gear and he stays in high gear almost from the beginning. He doesn't have that exceptional gear that you sometimes see from closers, but he doesn't need it because his fifth gear is better than everyone else's fifth gear at this point in time. Ironically enough, when the constitutions were first coming out, the ones that were seemed to be touted the most, at least the sales, were out of Tisnow Mares. And it looks like, you know, albeit it's a small sample, there were two constitutions out of Tisnow Mares that have both won great estate races. So it should be an interesting thing just from a genetic standpoint, just to watch that that cross going forward. Be that as it may, you know, no reason why Tis the Law shouldn't be the number one candidate right now. The only problem is the timetable. Now you have to wait 4.5-5 months before the Derby, and maybe even longer. Nobody knows as far as when the Preakness and the Belmont are going to be run. So it's kind of a weird situation. I'd be curious on the interview later on this today, you know, how Jack feels that's going to alter the plans for a horse like this.
Kind of touching on two of your points, Joe, I think he kind of reminds me of, you know, the knock on American Pharoah was always that, oh, he always gets a perfect trip, but he kind of always made his own trip kind of in a similar way. I'm not comparing the two, but, you know, those horses with tactical speed usually manage to find to get out of trouble. And I guess my one knock on him, and I've been a fan of him from the start as well, is that maybe he's with a September Derby, it's not really going to, you know, he was a precocious horse. Maybe come September, he'll kind of be a little over the top. I guess, you know, we'll see how they manage him from here, but maybe a little negative in the back of my mind, but I still think he's obviously very talented.
And I think the Bill's point was interesting about who would be favored if we had the Derby. I would lean towards Charlatan just because I think people fall in love with those giant figures. But I think Tizzolo would be right there with Authentic and Nadal battling for a second choice. What I think is kind of interesting, too, is that a lot of these prep races have really been kind of blowouts, like Tis the Law twice now. We had Authentic. I guess Nadal was in sort of a dog fight, but it seems to me like this is the kind of class where the top echelon has really separated themselves. And a lot of years, I don't think that's the case. A lot of years, I think there's a big muddle between like the first 8 or 10 contenders. I think this year, you kind of have that clear cream of the crop. But because of the postponement of the Derby, this could look completely different in 4 or 5 months from now. So I am looking forward to talking to Jack and seeing what the plan is, because this is such an unorthodox situation for these 3-year-old colts, where it's like now is when they're supposed to be peaking. And now all these owners and trainers kind of have to hit a bit of a reset button for these horses. So it's tricky. It's something we've never seen before. But I think at this moment, I think you do have a clear top class of 3-year-olds.
I think one thing that's interesting is they actually are offering a future wager this week. And I know, I think on one of the other podcasts, we talked about how we thought they might refund the earlier pools. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. And I mean, you have to definitely look at the field for this one and maybe think about taking that if you get any kind of price on it, just because there's so much racing left to come before we actually have a Derby, if we have a Derby.
Yeah, and a couple of points to make. Back to what you said, Joe. I think right now there's four that have separated themselves from the pack, which would be the three Baffert horses that you mentioned, and Tis the Law. I mean, I think if you look at anybody who's doing a top 20 poll, that would pretty much be their top four, unless, you know, you really want to go the wise guy route. But again, I want to touch on the point you made and how important this is that on today, on April 1st versus September 5th, the day that we're supposed to run the Derby, so many things can change. And one thing that comes to mind is, let's go back a few months on the calendar, right around January 1st, where the Derby was 5 months away at the time when we thought it was going to be in May. And essentially now the Derby is once again 5 months away. Remember Independence Hall? He was everybody. He was the rage. He was number one. And everybody ran these. He wasn't running against anybody, but he ran these huge figures in the Nashua Stakes. And, you know, he looked like the real deal. Fast forward to today, April 1st. I mean, he's out there, but he's getting beaten in these races. Nobody even knows he exists. Nobody talks about him anymore. So that's just one example of how quickly things can change. And, you know, I think Tis the Law is a very good horse. I think Barkley Tag is a good trainer. And I think he's going to figure this out. But these are huge ifs. And in some respects, you know, obviously we have to talk now about who's number one, who did the best running now. But, you know, I'll go back to another point. The Kentucky Derby winner, if it's run in September, very well could be a horse that none of us even know exists right now. That's how fluid this situation is. And it makes it even more perplexing when there's no path now. I mean, in a traditional Derby, there's always the path. You know, guys will pick the 2-3 races they want to run in. Fountain Youth Florida Derby into the Kentucky Derby. Rebel Arkansas Derby into the Kentucky Derby. What's the path? Nobody knows. Nobody has a an idea of any way, shape, or form. You know, that makes it in some respects fascinating, but I'm sure, you know, the horsemen like Baffert and Barkley Tag and other people with good horses right now are incredibly frustrated by this. They almost have to be.
Well, and it goes back to, Bill, what we were talking about on previous podcasts, which is they're going to have to reassign points to some of these major graded stake races. Because right now, you know, one of the Baffert horses wouldn't even make it based on points. And I'm looking at the top 20, you know, point totals right now. And basically, you know, you have at the bottom, you have Candy Tycoon, Honor AP, or Accession, who we're not even talking about as far as being, you know, possible Kentucky Derby candidates, let alone, you know, favorites for the race. So it'd be interesting to see how they're going to reconjigger all the points for some of these bigger races down the road, because that's going to have a major factor on actually who gets into the race.
Reconjigger.
It's a word.
That's definitely going to be a DJ horse name.
It's yeah. 11 points.
I reserve that. I hope it's more than that.
Well, there is a silent Z, so I guess you're right, Brian. It would be 16 points.
I kind of want to ask both Brian and John. I guess I'll start with Brian. We talked about this a little last week in the Lost podcast, but because I wonder now, where, with so much uncertainty, if you do consider sending horses to the farm for a little bit, just so, because there's no race really to point to. But and people have made the argument that, I mean, you can't just send a fit horse to the farm. They're going to kick the doors down. So I wonder if you guys had a top 3-year-old at this moment with no clear goal in sight, what would you look to do?
I think I'd keep him in light training with a horse like that. I don't think I'd take him out of training. Obviously, it's a case-by-case thing. But we have run into that problem. We have probably 4 horses right now that we could probably go either way on. But I think when you're talking about a horse, a lot of it usually is, you know, you want to manage expenses. But when you're dealing with a Derby kind of horse, I think that's probably less of a consideration.
Yeah, I concur, Brian. I think that if you have a really top horse, you want to keep them in training, even if it's light training. I don't necessarily agree with the, you can't bring a fit racehorse to a farm because it'll hurt itself or kick the doors down. I think that, you know, unfortunately, or, you know, all the horses are kind of medicated anyway, whether they're at the track or they're on a farm, you know, to kind of temper their enthusiasm a little bit. So, you know, that argument doesn't necessarily hold a lot of water with me. What we've opted to do with a lot of our younger horses is, you know, occasionally through training, you're going to pop a splint, or you're going to, you know, have a horse that's going to have a problem breathing, or you're going to have, you know, a minor issue. Now's the time that we're taking care of those and addressing those. So I was on the call with our trainers, you know, over the course of the weekend, and basically said to them, go through everything that we have. And if anyone needs to have a splint freeze fired, or we need to do something minor, you know, you need to geld up a colt that is acting up, do it now. Do it over these next couple of weeks, where you have the manpower and B, have the time to address these things. You know, you asked before about if you have a top 3-year-old, what do you point for? And it actually worked in reverse for us, because we had a filly named Colby, who actually won a stake race early on in her 2-year-old career, and had to have ankle surgery, and we popped the chip out and gave her some time. And now she's starting to come back, and she'll actually come back, hopefully when racing resumes, you know, in May or June. And what we're hoping is that she's going to continue to progress and maybe make the Oaks. So in this case, we actually may have gotten lucky and have a horse that now we didn't think was going to be, you know, ready for the Oaks or for any of those preps, and now may be ready for some of those.
I mean, that's going to be the case with a lot of horses, I think. And that's the silver lining in this, is that it makes it a little bit more exciting that, yeah, maybe it's not quite the test that it was to have the Derby in May when horses are still developing, and that some of them haven't even reached their 3-year-old birthday. But I think in September, if we are able to run it, then I think you're going to have a much more diverse field. I think you have a much more developed field. And I think you're going to see better horses, and everybody is going to be clamoring to get in, not just the Derby, but anywhere we're going to be clamoring to get into these few remaining spots towards the end of the year. And I think if we are able to see this through to the other side and things start to get back to normal in the summer, you're going to have a really hell of a last 3 months or so of the racing year. So I think there is that to look forward to.
Now, if somebody breaks the stakes record for the Oaks or the Derby, because it's run in September, should that count?
Yeah, why not?
Well, just because they're 6 months more developed, which in horse years is a lot of development time.
Yeah, I don't know. I find it hard to believe someone's going to break Secretariat's 224 in the Belmont. I think we might be clear on that one, at least. We'll see.
Challenge accepted.
All right.
I'm going to start training now.
Only Blue Buff was a three-year-old.
Exactly. Yeah. If only. That's the truth.
Yeah. I wanted to mention that, though, because we talked about Blue Buff on the show, so it's a decent callback. John's horse, DJ Stables' horse, that had to go on the shelf a couple times and has come back running. I think he's won three in a row now. Had a really nice allowance win the other day at Gulfstream. I half-jokingly said he should go to the Met Mile next, but he does look like he's headed for stakes next. Get an update?
Really, it's going to come down to what races are available. The nice thing about him is that he is eligible for all these starter races. So we'll continue to beat up on some of these starters down there. And then eventually, now that we know that he can handle, you know, the distance, first it was a mile, then and now it's two turns. Now it looks like that he's able to do all those things. We'll probably step him up in a little while. But we're a slave to the condition book right now. Because in the Gulfstream book, at least for the next couple of weeks, there are no stake races whatsoever at Gulfstream. So even if we wanted to jump them up in class, we couldn't. And that's one of the frustrating things about racing right now is you're limited, obviously, to the number of tracks. But also the tracks are getting savvy to this and saying, we're the only game in town. So why should we put up more purse money than we need to? And you saw some stake races that were reduced in purse money. And then some tracks are eliminating stake races altogether. I think other than the one in Nebraska, there's very few stakes coming up. And that was a $15,000 added stake at Fodder Racetrack.
Was Blue Buff not eligible for that? Why didn't you ship?
I'm afraid he gets stuck there.
Yeah, that's definitely a concern.
No, Joe, all kidding aside, if he was a filly, we probably would consider shipping him out of town. But he's a six-year-old gelding, so there's no, and we don't own the family, so there's no real benefit to getting black type for him at this point.
This week's news is sponsored by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. West Point did have a big horse, quote-unquote, coming back over the weekend in the Cutler Bay Stakes. They had Decorated Invader, who won the summer last year at Woodbine, had a tough trip in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf, and really was very confidently handled, I think, by Joel Rosario the whole time on Saturday and ran down some pretty decent horses. So, you know, obviously the racing calendar is up in the air, but not the worst thing in the world to have a three-year-old turf horse, you know, assuming we are able to run that turf triple at in New York. So shout out to them and congrats for Decorated Invader's victory. Owning a multiple graded stakes winning racehorse like Hard Not to Love is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Check out why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit our website, westpointtb.com. We'll now transition from the racing news into the overall news, which of course is the rapidly developing situation of the coronavirus across the world, but especially here in America now, where we have the most cases in the world, and it's kind of still going in a scary direction. And here in the New York area, we're probably a couple weeks, week or two away from the peak, and it's already like really scary. I hear sirens basically all the time. It's a really spooky kind of post-apocalyptic kind of feeling. As far as the racing world, that relates to some news over the past week, which was that Aqueduct is not going to run for the rest of the meet, and they're going to transform into a hospital site. That's happening in a lot of places in New York, the Javits Center. We obviously had the big ship, the USNS Comfort, come into the Hudson River the other day. Belmont is scheduled to start at the end of April. It does not seem like that's too realistic right now. I think even if we start to go on the other side of this curve in late April, I think, you know, people are still going to be recovering. And we heard that six backstretch workers were infected with COVID. It does not seem realistic to me, at least. I'm not an expert, but that we will be racing before, say, June. And I think, you know, we talked about this a little bit last week, but New York because it's being hit so hard right now, I think is going to be one of the first areas to recover. We're going to be the first over that hump, so to speak. I think a lot of people recovering and developing immunity is going to help. It's going to be hellish probably here for another month or so. But, you know, it's going to be difficult because there are certain other states and cities who are not taking this as seriously. We don't have a nationwide lockdown like we have. Like there is in other countries right now, like Italy and Spain. It's hard with a huge country of 350 million people to get everybody to pay attention and follow orders. But, you know, we have this kind of patchwork system right now where certain states are on lockdown, certain states have partial stay-at-home orders. I think what's going to happen is that it's going to pop up at other places. I think in Florida, maybe in a month or so. I think it's just, it's going to be kind of like this relay race, I would say. It's not the right analogy because nobody wants to win, but I think, you know, eventually it's going to be passed to Florida and other places. The hope is that by the summer, when the warm weather comes around, that this will die down and then maybe it'll come back in the fall. But I just kind of want to open it up to you guys and see how you're feeling about the racing schedule. We also had the news that the Santa Anita June 2-year-old sales can be canceled. Santa Anita over the past week was one of the last tracks standing, and they have now suspended racing and postponed the Santa Anita Derby. It seems to get worse by the week, but hopefully we will be able to see on the other side of this thing in about a month or so. How do you guys feel about the racing calendar going forward?
Well, first of all, I have a suggestion for next week's Green Group Guest of the Week. Can we get Dr. Anthony Fauci to come on?
He's everywhere. He's on every show. He might as well come on our show.
Absolutely. You know, I don't know this either. There's six of these guys or he doesn't sleep or something to that effect. I mean, obviously, a lot of thoughts about this. Losing Santa Anita was very big and a big blow. Hopefully, they haven't given up on coming back. And, you know, it's kind of ironic that you're racing in Northern California, Golden Gate, but not in Southern California at Santa Anita. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But then again, a lot of things during this time don't make a lot of sense. Joe, you know, guessing when racing will return or when it'll be somewhat normal. I mean, that's all we're doing is guessing. You know, we're hoping that it's not going to be 3-4 months from now, you know, just maybe by June 1st, we don't know. But here's a couple of stories to keep your eye on as this continues to go forward. First of all, the plight of trainers. And right now at outside of, what are we down to? 6 racetracks. And remember, several of those are getting ready to end their meets. I mean, Oakland, Tampa Bay are not going on forever. Those meets end Oakland in early May and Tampa Bay around the same time. The plight of trainers. And I talked to some guys at Parks this week because they've been closed down since March 10th. So they're going on the 3 weeks of being shut down. And they have no income coming in. No, the day rate only pays their expenses. And most of those guys say it's really not even enough to pay their expenses. So what are they going to do going forward when they're not earning any purse money? And the reason why I bring that up is, you know, what will they do about laying off employees? Which is, you know, another big factor here that nobody wants to see. You know, the backstretch guys have a pretty tough go of it to begin with. And, you know, what's going to happen if these guys are out of work? And sort of on that same vein, what about the horses? And we talked about this last week a little bit where I said, well, DJ Stables horses are too good. They're not going anywhere nefarious or nothing bad is going to happen to them. But when there's no racing anywhere and these horses lose their economic value, so, you know, the $5,000 claimer is not worth $5,000 anymore if he can't race. And, you know, I shudder to think what is going to happen to these horses. And are we sitting on a new crisis, you know, 2-3 months from now where, you know, the whole slaughter pipeline, which is one thing racing's done a good job of containing. It's a problem that's not nearly as bad as it used to be. But is that going to explode on us? It's quite possible. And, you know, that's another thing we just don't need to happen.
The only silver lining out of all this is that, you know, Congress did enact the CARE Act, which is the Coronavirus Aid Relief, you know, Economic Security Act. And they will allow federal loans and grants to small businesses. And they're also allowing and giving money out, you know, in the form of a stimulus. There's loan forgiveness. There's also mortgage payments that can be skipped. There's a whole host of different payments that can be either skipped altogether or at least postponed for 60 to 120 days, depending on the situation. So there is some relief coming down the road economically to hopefully, you know, buoy not only small trainers, but small businesses in general, which, you know, which pepper the entire landscape here of the thoroughbred industry. So hopefully that will, you know, get some money out there and continue the flow of money until racing starts again. One of the things that I thought went under the radar this week was that the governor of Maryland, Governor Hogan, announced that the Preakness will not be held on the third Saturday of May, and they're unsure of any new dates. So I thought it was interesting that came from a politician and not from the Stronach group, or not as a joint statement. But I think that Hogan was actually making a statement by saying, no, we're saying that we're not having it on the third Saturday of May, which I thought really went unannounced or unrecognized when the press release came out.
I mean, I kind of had already thought that they had kind of decided it was going to happen in September, but I guess there was nothing official. The rumors that I'm hearing about when we can expect to race again are kind of frightening, just what people are kind of bracing for. I don't know how accurate they are, but in the two jurisdictions where we kind of focus on, New York and Kentucky, I mean, I don't think they're planning to run anytime soon. People are kind of wondering if we might not be running until Saratoga. Obviously, nobody really knows anything, and we're all just kind of in the dark still, but I guess it'll, you know, we'll see when we actually get to go back to racing. And to Bill's point about retirement, I actually just want to give a shout out to Larry Ravelli. We retired a horse a few days ago, and he was the original trainer of the horse. I guess the horse is named after his son. And he called us up and wanted to send the horse to his farm. So, you know, he did the right thing. At least, you know, one horse kind of is going to end up with a good home. I do think that's something to kind of be worried about going forward. And I think a lot of these retirement organizations are already inundated a little bit. So I think that's definitely something to watch out for in the future. But hopefully more people, you know, keep doing the right thing.
Related to that, I wanted to mention it kind of went under the radar a little bit, but the governor of Ohio, the state of Ohio, mandated that the backstretch stay open and that horses don't get evicted. Same thing, similar thing going on in Ontario, you know, deemed an essential service to take care of these horses on the backstretch. I think that's a good thing when the government can get involved so that, it's so restrictive in these places that are getting hit hardest that I think it's good to establish the baseline that these horses have to be taken care of. The backstretch workers a lot of them live on the backstretch. They need to be able to work. So I think it's good that, you know, the government is stepping in a little bit, because that's, I don't know, it's just, if there isn't regulation in that way, I think a lot of people might be forced to do stuff they wouldn't normally do, and horses might disappear in the pipeline somewhere. So I think that's a good part of it. I also wanted to mention, Bill had a great story yesterday with Javier Castellano. And obviously, this was kind of one of the things that drove home the impact on racing that coronavirus has had when Javier Castellano tested positive. I thought he had a lot of really great quotes about how, you know, he felt fine. He personally felt fine and didn't really need any treatment. And if he hadn't tested positive, he hadn't gotten the test, he would have been out spreading it. And I think that's the biggest concern right now, is people who aren't asymptomatic carriers who are carrying on as if everything is normal, and then they're passing it along to people who can't handle the disease or the infection quite as well. So I just wanted to give a hat tip to Bill and Javier. It was a great piece. Bill, if you wanted to add anything to that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, one thing that I took away from it is, you know, you look at the coronavirus and most people look at it from a physical standpoint. You know, what's it doing to you physically, from basically having no symptoms whatsoever to which is the case with Castellano, to unfortunately people passing away. But he shed a light on another area of it that really goes, has flown under the radar a little bit, is the mental aspects of it. You know, you're young, healthy, you're feeling great, and you walk into a doctor's office and they say, hey, I'm sorry to tell you, you have coronavirus. And he said he was absolutely shocked. He said he actually even like repeated his name, his address. You know, he thought they had the wrong person. You know, my name's Javier Castellano. You must mean that somebody named Javier Sanchez has gotten this, and you got it all wrong. Like, how can this be? And he said the uncertainty of what was going on and the worry about that. He says one of the toughest things he's ever faced in his life. So this is coming from somebody who has had basically no physical symptoms. You know, imagine how much harder it must be and how awful it must be for somebody who has the symptoms. But, you know, he's he's battling away. He's home. He's doing what he's supposed to do. He said the right things. He's telling people, look, you know, stay at home, which is what everybody's saying right now. It's for the best thing. And, he thinks he'll be ready to ride actually in a week or two after his quarantine period is over. But of course, he doesn't have any place to ride. He doesn't want to go back to Florida. Well, actually, he's in Florida now. He doesn't want to ride in Florida. He wants to be home with his family in New York. And as you mentioned earlier, I mean, the best case scenario is Naira gets going again with the opening of the Belmont meet in April. But it doesn't seem to me like that's practical. You know, again, let the guesswork. You know, Javier Castellano may ride his next race come in June when Belmont opens, and let's hope it's that soon. Let's hope it's June, and we're not talking beginning of Saratoga or something like that.
And I actually had a similar story with Mike Klein, Sean Tugel, and Ned Toffee. I was talking to some of the biggest names at these breeding farms about what they were doing to combat the coronavirus, and Mike Klein had a good quote that said, just assume you have the virus and act accordingly. I think most people at this point have gotten it through their heads that this is a major, major problem and you could be a vector. But I think there are some people who just, I don't know whether they think they're invincible or they think it's a hoax. I don't know what would make them think that. But they're not listening. I think if you somehow are watching, listening to this podcast and you don't understand the severity of it, get familiar real quick, because this is a huge problem and it's only going to get worse the less people listen to guidance. And I think just because you feel okay doesn't mean that you are okay. And you need to take precautions, not just for yourself, but for some of the most vulnerable people in your community. You know, I have friends. Most of my friends are taking it seriously. Some other ones are like still trying to play basketball and stuff. Like they had to take down 80 hoops in the city. The NYPD had to go around to all these playgrounds and take down these basketball hoops because people are still out there playing games. Like some people just, they don't get it, man. You can't trust people to do the right thing. So that's why I think it would have been better to have a nationwide lockdown. But, you know, until then, I think you just got to get it through your head that this is a serious thing and you could be contributing to the problem if you don't stay at home.
I thought one thing that was interesting about Bill's story about Javier was that he was able to get a test because you keep hearing how there aren't that many tests out there. And it didn't sound like he was actually with somebody who was already confirmed to have it. I guess the StrongNet group has some pull and they were able to get some tests, but it was a little surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of been a consistent theme is like, you know, if you're well off, if you're famous, like all these basketball players got like 50 tests like that, like the night that they shut down the NBA season. So, you know, I mean, that's a problem, but you know, it's one of those things that our healthcare system unfortunately allows for is that these people, you can't just get a test if you need one. All right. So in the quest to have more content every week and different content every week, you know, it's, you know, other than coronavirus updates, it's going to be a little bit of a dearth of news in the coming weeks and maybe months. We don't want to depress everybody with nonstop corona updates. You can get enough of that on the news. We wanted to talk about a couple of things today, a couple more general topics. We're going to start with our favorite horses. And I think this will be an interesting discussion because we kind of span generations and eras here. I'll start. My favorite horse that I've ever seen run, and I got to see him in person, thankfully, is Ghost Zapper. Ghost Zapper, I started following racing in 2003, and he was a three-year-old that year. And the most impressive race I saw that entire year, visually, was Ghost Zapper in the Vosburgh Stakes. If you haven't seen it, go on YouTube, find the 2003 Vosburgh. Pretty much the most impressive turn of foot I've ever seen on a dirt horse, even since then. Just an absolutely incredible performance. Inhaled the leaders and ran off to win by 6 or 7 lengths, seemingly in the blink of an eye. And then, of course, the next year, he came back. He's obviously had physical issues. He had issues with his feet. Bobby Frankel managed him the best he could. He ran that enormous, I think it was 131 or 128 buyer in the Islin in the Mama's Slop. Then I was there the day he ran in the Woodward. He ran against St. Liam, and St. Liam carried him out to the parking lot, and Ghost Zapper still wore him down and won. Obviously, then he had that tremendous performance going wire to wire to beat, at least in my racing lifetime, I think the best Breeders' Cup Classic field I've ever seen that year at Lone Star Park. And Roses of May, Pleasantly Perfect, all these really terrific horses. And he pretty much crushed him. Unfortunately, he only ran one more time after that. I was there again the following spring. My dad and I used to go out when the Met Mile was on Memorial Day. We used to go out there every Memorial Day. And he had another incredible, incredible performance. I remember the other big favorite in that race was Forrest Danger. And Ghost Zapper just, you know, completely intimidated him and blew him away to the point where Forrest Danger was running as far away from him as possible. He was running sideways more than he was running forward. Just, I love versatility and resources. That's like the thing that I prize the most, is horses that can run on the lead, who can come from off the pace, who can sprint, who can route. I mean, I feel like he would have been a good turf horse too. And I'm glad to see he's become a great sire too. He's become a really good sire. It was a little iffy at first when he first started, but you know, he's sired a ton of grade one winners, mostly fillies, strangely, for whatever reason. I think like 11 out of his 14 grade one winners, something like that, are fillies and mares. So hat tip to Ghost Zapper, really, really kind of solidified my love for the game.
If anybody followed me when I was writing for the New York Daily News back in the era when newspapers actually realized that horse racing existed, be no surprise what I'm about to say. Mine was Easygoer. And, you know, in a way, he broke my heart because, you know, at the end of the day, he didn't come through. But myself and most people in New York just fell in love with this horse. And to this day, I still think deep down, he was better than Sunday Silence. I just think there were circumstances that prevented him from proving that. But then you have this one race, the Belmont Stakes, which was, to me, was the greatest day of my life so far as following racing as a fan, as a journalist. And you know, having said that, you're not supposed to have favorite horses as a journalist. You're supposed to be impartial. I was not. I mean, blatantly just out there. I loved Easygoer. I was, you know, a big cheerleader for him. You know, I was reluctant to give Sunday Silence any credit. I don't think I did until after he beat Easygoer in the Breeders' Cup Classic. But I remember this, the euphoria I felt after the Belmont Stakes, because, you know, all along we had believed in this horse. We thought that he was going to be, I mean, literally another Secretariat. And he's a very, very good horse. He didn't turn out to be another Secretariat. But this one day in the Belmont Stakes, everything we believed came to fruition. Not only did he beat Sunday Silence that day, he clobbered him. And then it was like, okay, now we know this horse is for real. This wasn't just hype. This is how good he is. What happened in the Derby, you know, who's to say? What happened in the Preakness, who's to say? It doesn't matter now. He won the Belmont, and he did so in this fashion of just, you know, superstardom. You know, next to Secretariat, it was probably as impressive as a Belmont there's ever been. Then, of course, in the Breeders' Cup Classic, you know, everybody wants to blame Pat Day. I don't blame Pat Day. I mean, the horse just didn't come through in the races that he lost. So, you know, in some ways, I've never had a favorite horse since then because, you know, it's like, you know, a bad marriage that breaks up. You don't want to deal with a heartache. You don't want to get involved in it because, you know, if you fall in love with this horse, you know, at the end of the day, they're going to break your heart. So, you know, I will always remember him. Unlike Ghost Zapper, he didn't turn out to be any kind of sire whatsoever, really not very good at all. But, you know, he provided so many days were just so thrilling to be around him. And, you know, again, we'll always have that Belmont Stakes. Easygoer fans can hold on to that and say, hey, at least on this one day, we were right. He was the best horse on the planet.
Yeah, you know, Bill, it's interesting because Easygoer was such a phenomenon as a racehorse and so good looking. And I think the reason why he didn't make it as a stallion was he only had two crops. And maybe it was like one and a half crops because he passed on so early on in his stallion career. So I think if given the opportunity, he would have been, you know, one of the sires that we still talk about today. My favorite horse, ironically enough, was from the same barn in the same camp, but just a couple years earlier, and that's Personal Ensign. And Personal Ensign started racing right about the time where we started getting very involved in the horse industry in the mid-80s. And she just checked every box for me. Phenomenally bred, undefeated in 13 starts, ranging from 7 furlongs to a mile and a quarter. First undefeated champion in 80 years. Grade one winner at 2 when she won the Frisette, at 3 when she won the Beldame against older mares, and at 4 where she rattled off 6 grade ones, including the Whitney against boys. And some people also say she beat the boys in the Breeders' Cup Distaff that year when she beat Winning Colors by a nose. But the fact that she was 13 for 13, undefeated, came off a major injury where she was off for an entire year. And then what did they do in order to get her prepped, you know, for some of the bigger races? But they ran her on literally back-to-back weekends at Belmont, where she won, obviously won them both because she's undefeated. So she just had it all. She checked all the boxes. She had the looks. She had the pedigree, really. She had the race career, won as a two-year-old and you know, was named a champion as a four-year-old. And then if that wasn't enough, she was also named Broodmare of the Year. And if you look at her foals, you know, and her career as a in the breeding shed, you know, she had Miner's Mark, Our Emblem, My Flag. You know, really, the list kind of goes on and on, which for a filly is unbelievable that you have three grade one winners and another two horses that were graded placed. So for me, hands down, Personal Ensign was my favorite horse to watch as a fan. But also when you look at that Breeders' Cup Distaff race where she beat Winning Colors and Goodbye Halo, literally in the last jump, it just makes your heart leap, you know, through your throat on a, you know, in a race like that. So for me, Personal Ensign was, you know, was the one that we always try to look for when we're buying or breeding horses since then.
And Personal Ensign's kind of, I think, the grand dam of a lot of good horses. You see her name pop up, obviously, in a lot of pedigrees, like a lot of Phipps horses. I'm usually the guy who's telling somebody why their favorite horse is overrated, but I'd say Royal Delta is probably my favorite of big name horses. You know, I just kind of early in my TDN career, I remember, you know, when we made her a rising star and all that, just obviously a well-bred horse, had that cool kind of APND running, you know, like head carriage. And she probably closed my biggest betting day ever at the Breeders' Cup, Churchill Downs. I just had like her singled in pretty much every bet. And I think it was probably my biggest day betting ever. So that's kind of how I am. It's usually the horses that you make scores on, but just a really cool horse. And she was a good little broodmare until, you know, she died prematurely.
I would say for me, the honorable mentions, I would go with Bernardini. It was incredible. Rachel Alexandra, obviously. A lot of these are memories I had at Saratoga when Rachel won the Woodward, I was there. When Bernardini won the Travers, I was there. I'd also say Harrogate, similar to Brian. He was the first rising star I made, and I, you know, followed him, and he had an incredible career as well. I'm interested to see how he starts off at stud. He's obviously got the mares to be a successful stallion, but we'll see how it goes. I wanted to segue a little bit from that into another topic, which is I wanted to talk about underrated stallions, you know, because we talk a lot, and obviously, you know, huge weekend for Constitution. American Pharoah's off to a great start. You got Into Mischief is every week has seemingly a new graded stakes winner. I wanted to talk about the ones that are flying a little bit under the radar. I'll bring up one that I think is less under the radar now, but is still underrated, which is Looking at Lucky. I think he's had a really good stallion career so far. He's gotten a little more attention because of Accelerate. But I think he's a horse that you can still get for a reasonable price over at Ashford. And I think he sires a pretty big percentage of stakes horses and graded stakes horses. As far as the new sires, I would keep an eye on Tapiture. You know, he doesn't have quite the book of mares that the Constitutions and the American Pharoahs have. But I think in terms of winners, in terms of straight out winners, first out winners, you know, precocious horses, I think Tapiture is holding his own in a very, very strong freshman sire class or now second crop sire class. Ryan, what do you think?
I always talk about Great Notion. I think he's the super underrated sire. He's, you know, the leading sire in Maryland pretty much every year now. But I used to do a lot of statistics with debut winners and ROI and stuff, and his stats were always really good. And he's not so far away from having made it as a Kentucky sire. I think he was second in the King's Bishop. He's by Elusive Quality. You know, if his career had gone a little differently, maybe you would have seen him in Kentucky with some better mares. Another regional one, I think Silent Name up in Ontario is excellent. Same thing, gets a ton of debut winners, you know, horses that can go short, go long. I've only ever seen one in person. There was a really nice Silent Name last year at Keeneland September that sold for, I think, 130,000. And he was a full to a graded stakes winner up there who was just a beautiful horse. He was probably like the best looking horse in book five or whatever. It was pretty late in the sale. I think it was book five or book four. But I think those are my two kind of sneaky ones.
The one I would add, if we're talking state bred sires, Smiling Tiger, I think, has had a really good early career in California, Harris Farms. He's, I feel like every time I see a Calbred stake for younger horses, I feel like he's sired like half the field. So he's one that I think, if we're going to talk state bred Red Sires. Jumpstart is another one that had done really well for a long time in Pennsylvania. I think Ken Farrow's kind of fit that bill, except now he's blown up more. But I think for a while in Florida, he was under the radar. But yeah, I think there's definitely some good sires hiding in these state bred programs somewhere. And you brought up a couple good ones. John, you got any thoughts?
The stallion game, before I give you my underrated stallion, the stallion game is really interesting because Kentucky Farms have this formula where you have to win at least a grade two in order to be even considered. Otherwise, you're immediately, you know, discounted and considered a regional horse. But that's why you see some of the ones you mentioned and Kentheros and Tiger. And I keep wanting to say the name of the show on Netflix, the
Tiger Game.
Yeah, exactly. And Silent Name and even Central Banker in New York, where these are horses that were really good horses. I mean, they won a bunch of grade twos. They were knocking on the door in grade one races, pretty well bred, you know, by whether it's the Son of Spites now or Lucid Quality, and, you know, and the list kind of goes on and on, but they're just not quite good enough to be considered a Kentucky Stallion. So they don't get the same kind of mare population or mare quality, but they win at a pretty good clip, especially in these regional racetracks.
Upset of all upsets that you brought up Central Banker before Brian did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
there was talk about him moving to Kentucky. I think there's been some interest, but we'll see.
And yeah, he's kind of near and dear to my heart because we were the co-breeder with Windstar on Central Banker. Yeah, the Spikes down out of our mare room, who is a New York, ironically enough, she's New York bred turf champion. And yet he, you know, I think because of Spikes now, he's having all these early developing dirt horses. So Central Banker has been on our radar for a lot of reasons, but mainly because we were involved, you know, in the actual mating of it way back when. As far as under the radar stallions, you know, this has been a stallion that we've bred to almost every year for the past 10, 12 years, and he hasn't gotten his due until this year. And that's Hardspun over at Darley. And Hardspun himself was a really good racehorse. And then, you know, at 16 years old, now is showing that he can throw horses that run long, short, turf, dirt. And he's become a great broodmare sire. He's the broodmare sire of Good Magic. And really, you know, we're just talking about horses that have to go regionally because they just don't win the grade one. Hardspun lost to Curlin twice and Street Sense twice. So if it wasn't for those two horses, he probably would have won three, maybe four grade one races. So he certainly had the race record or the talent. He just ran up against a couple of buzzsaws in his crop. And the other reason why I like Hardspun is he's like the last son of Danzig that's out there. He's really an outcross between Danzig on the top side and Turkoman on the bottom side, and Roberto even more so on the bottom side. You just don't see that in modern day pedigrees anymore. So I love horses like that are throwbacks to some of these great stallions. And, you know, whether it's Hardspun, you know, with the Danzig, Turkoman, and Roberto lines, or I even wrote down, you know, Sky Mesa, you know, with the Pulpit and Stormcat lines that you just don't see up close anymore. But yet they still throw consistent horses that can run on turf, dirt, synthetic, broken glass, whatever it is. And now Hardspun has actually made the leap, becoming not only a great sire like of Hard Not to Love and Antoinette and Green Light Go for this year, but also as a broodmare sire. And I think you're going to see that pattern continuing as he gets, as his foals start to get, you know, to development age in the breeding game.
I was a big fan of Hardspun too. Again, similar to Brian, I cashed a big exacta in the Derby when Street Sense won and he ran second. He really ran an incredible race that day. That was a fast pace and he was clear for second. And Curlin was third, obviously a terrific 3-year-old class. So I agree. I love Hardspun as one of those last great sons of Danzig and carrying on that line. A couple other ones I wanted to mention, just looking at the TDN sire list, Midnight Loot actually is among North American stallions. He has the most earnings right now. Obviously a lot of that is Midnight Bijou running second in the Saudi Cup, but I think he's another one that, you know, when he ran, he was almost exclusively a sprinter, but I feel like he gets pretty much every kind of horse. I feel like I'm saying I was at every big race, but I was also at the Breeders' Cup when he won the sprint. I was in the building at that hideous, rainy Monmouth Breeders' Cup.
I thought I saw you there.
Well, I was there. Yeah, we were probably, I bet all four of us were there. We didn't even know each other. I remember getting lost around the streets of Monmouth, like trying to find our car after the fact. And now it's funny that we live, you know, like 10 minutes away. But at the time, it was like a totally different world. I couldn't find where I was going.
That was crazy. I feel kind of bad for Monmouth. I feel like they haven't gotten the Breeders' Cup back.
Yeah, that was really screwed.
Yeah. Then there's two more. Munnings, I think he's starting to get a little bit more attention now, but he's obviously had a great year with the three-year-old fillies. Yeah. And Painter, I think Painter is a little bit interesting. I think as far as value sires, he's $10,000 right now at Windstar. I think he can throw some pretty good horses. And I think particularly on the turf, I like him with turf horses. That's just a couple more that I would throw in as underrated sires.
Yep. And maybe you can even throw in some of the older horses like Distorted Humor, Spitestown, Tis Now, you know, where they're more than ready, you know, where they're always knocking on the door. It always seems like that one, if not all four of them, have a horse that's a Derby contender, or it's an Oaks contender, or a Breeders' Cup, you know, candidate. And yet people aren't breeding to those horses because they're just not as sexy as some of the new ones are now. But we've, you know, our breeding program, we've done okay, you know, breeding to horses like that. It still seems like there's a commercial market for it. The Pinnockers still love, you know, most of those kind of horses, and the end users love all those kind of horses. So, I'm surprised that you can still get to some of those old proven horses. They're like the Bill Finleys of stallions.
He had to say his name so he would wake up.
Italian conversation.
I like Tappet. He's a good sire. Next.
Right. Yeah, thanks, Bill.
Pedigree stallion expert Bill Finley. There's one thing I want to give a shout out to our publisher, Sue Finley, for this idea. We're going to run a little series in the TDN coming up called Silver Linings. One of these things where if you're home all the time, yeah, it sucks. Like the social isolation thing kind of sucks. And, you know, obviously it really sucks if you get sick. But if you are able to stay healthy, there are positive things to being able to stay home, spend more time at home, obviously spend more time with family. So we're going to go around the room like this is kindergarten. And we're each going to say one thing that we kind of have enjoyed about being stuck in our homes. I'll go first and I'll say that I'm cooking more. You know, my girlfriend and I used to fall back a lot on ordering takeout and delivery all the time. Obviously it's really expensive, but you also get sick of the same food all the time. We're cooking a lot more and cooking a lot of different stuff. So I think that's kind of a little transferable skill to the other side of the coronavirus era, hopefully.
Well, mine's easy. I had a catch with my son the other day, just old fashioned father and son having a catch. And I don't think I've done that with him for 6 or 7 years. He was a great baseball player coming up through high school and everything like that. I had an elbow injury that derailed his career. But just to get out there, like, you know, throw back to the time when things were simpler, and that's how fathers and sons interacted. So I got him away from the video games just long enough so that I could have a catch with him.
Nice.
Yeah, no, that's great. That is really quality time there. I was going to say something similar. We've been playing a lot of board games, a lot of cards with the kids just to, you know, I have my two daughters who normally are in Maine and DC respectively, and they're home now. So we've been getting some quality time there, but I've also been listening to a lot of our former podcasts. And I have to say that, you know, from a level of competency, we've gotten better. But also a lot of predictions that we talked about have come to fruition. So they're worth a good read, a good listen, at least after the first, you know, three or four of them. I think we really hit stride and started to really get together. So that's actually been really enjoyable for me, is just to listen to some of these podcasts and think, wait, how could Brian say that? And then be like, oh crap, Brian was right, you know, 3 weeks later. Or how could Joe bring up that topic? And then, you know, cause that's crazy. And then find out 3 weeks later, it was crazy, but you know, but we still as our leader and our steerer here. But yeah, that's been really enjoyable. Has been, you know, just trying to go back and listen to what we were predicting and then see how it unfolded.
I kind of, Joe, same thing. We've been cooking a lot more, which has been nice. The dog, I think, has been enjoying it. She's getting 24/7, you know, attention. Not that she doesn't when we bring her to the office, but I know that she's kind of loving this. She doesn't know what's going on, but she's having fun. We've been able to clear the Netflix queue a little quicker, which is always good. I don't know. We might run out of shows if we're, you know, cooped up for, you know, another month or two, but for now, you know, that part's been good.
I'll agree with the dog thing right here. I got Cyrus.
There you go.
Right on my lap. It's their favorite time ever. It's the everybody's home all the time era. I don't even know about the coronavirus. Ignorance is bliss. Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, I'm happy all you guys are staying healthy and well and making good use of the time. And we hope that our listeners slash viewers are doing the same thing.
Congratulations to us on leaping to the next generation of video now.
Yeah. I'm so glad all the listeners and also all the viewers can watch John Green's face. That's really a technological advancement that really the world needed. So Bill and I talked to Jack Knowlton, the principal of Saratoga Stable. Obviously, they had a funny side back in the day, and now they got another huge Derby contender in Tis the Law. Whenever the Derby's going to be run, hopefully he'll be there. Here's what Jack had to say.
Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they were bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. So we're thrilled this week to bring on Jackson Knowlton. Jack Knowlton, the principal of Saratoga Stable, obviously a funny side, and now Tis the Law. Jack, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, happy to do though.
Okay, great. So I just wanted to start by asking, I kind of feel like a connection to you guys because I started following racing in large part because of Funny Side and being such an underdog and a New York bred. I just kind of wanted to know how this feels this time around now that you're a little bit more experienced. How does this feeling compare with Tis the Law to the ride you're on Funny Side?
Well, it really is totally different because, as you remember, Funny Side was a New York bred, as is Tis the Law. And he's also a gelding. There had never been a New York bred to win the Kentucky Derby. There hadn't been a gelding since 1929 when Clyde Van Dusen did it. So the fact that he beat New York breds in three races as a two-year-old didn't really get anybody's attention. Then he ran fifth in the Holy Bull after he had the 13 post, ran second after a positive for the second place finisher in Louisiana Derby, and then, you know, was second to Empire Maker in the Wood. So going into the Derby, he was really under the radar, and, you know, he went off at 12-1, paid 27.60 with a win. So that was a whole different situation. Once you won the Derby, obviously, then, you know, you're on top of the horse racing world, and then, you know, quadrupled it after winning the Preakness. With Tis the Law, you know, he won impressively, broke his maiden at Saratoga, but then jumped up and won the Grade One Champagne in October at Belmont. So when that happened, all of a sudden, you know, he was on everybody's radar screen. In a lot of places, he was, you know, near the top or at the top of, you know, the two-year-olds. We had a little bump in the road when he went to Churchill and ran third in the Jockey Club race on a, you know, track that, you know, was about as wet as you could get. It just rained and rained and rained some more there. And he got stuck down inside, never got a chance to really make his run. But then came back and, you know, won the Holy Bull here before the Florida Derby. So now everybody has got him, you know, at the top or near the top of the Derby horses. And, you know, all of the press and doing what I'm doing today is because everybody thinks that he's one of the ones that should show up on the first Saturday in September. Which sounds really strange.
Well, Jack, let's stay on that same topic. And we have a lot more to ask you about the Florida Derby and getting to the weirdest Kentucky Derby in history, run in the first Saturday in September, as you said. But what was more fun? Now, obviously, with Funny Side winning the Kentucky Derby, you know, that was a great experience. You may or may not have that experience with Tis the Law. But from the day they first raced as a two-year-old to their last traditional Kentucky Derby prep, was it more fun to have a horse that nobody was paying attention to or a horse that is on top and you know, probably 50% of all the Kentucky Derby polls?
Well, you know, it was just so different because the group of owners is so different. There were 10 of us in the Funny Side group, and five of them were guys I went to high school with. So we were, you know, a very close-knit group, had known each other for a long time. And, you know, the group we've got now, there are 32 people that have, you know, some ownership interest in Tiz. And this group of people has melded together, and they are a partying crew. And as you saw, you know, after we won you know, particularly the holy bull. You know, the track announcer said, well, I think that we may need to increase the size of the winner's circle for Sagatoga. It's just been great. And, you know, working with the tracks to, you know, get accommodations. It's almost like I never had to do anything like that before the Kentucky Derby. Here, you know, every race that Tiz goes to, you know, we plan for, you know, 60, 70, 80 people and, you know, figure out where we're going to be. I mean, we had three suites that were set aside for us for the Florida Derby and expected, you know, somewhere 70, 80 people. Didn't happen. I mean, and that probably, you know, was the biggest disappointment. So it's very different. You know, both of them were fun, but you know, we've had a couple of chances to really celebrate and enjoy things. We took, you know, 70 people down to Louisville for the Jockey Club race. You know, we celebrated the night before. Unfortunately, we didn't get to celebrate after the race, but we did make up for that after we won the Holy Bull. So hopefully we'll have some other occasions where we can get everybody together. And, you know, if the world works right for us, we'll be able to have a couple more celebrations.
I was saying, like, I had a connection with you guys. I felt a connection with you guys. It's also because, you know, it's such a blue collar story. The guys, the high school friends taking the school bus to the Kentucky Derby. And it was just very relatable and cool. That's the kind of story we really love in horse racing. I want to know, since then, and since you've been around the game a little bit more, what have you learned from your experiences and maybe just about life in general since the days of Sunnyside?
It's a tough game. It's a tough sport. We are so blessed. Never in my life did I think that, you know, Sagatoga would have, you know, another horse that you could use in the same sentence as Kentucky Derby. I mean, we buy one, maybe two horses a year, only New York breds. The most we've ever paid for a horse is $180,000. We bought Tiz for $110,000. So our expectations are very modest. We love the game. Owners, it's, you know, friends, family. It's word of mouth. You know, we don't advertise for people. And, you know, we've gone through a long spell without having, you know, any horse that was, you know, notable in its success. We did win a stake up at Saratoga, I think, in 2008. But Funny Side ran, you know, from, you know, 2002 to 2007. Ended his career as a seven-year-old winning a stake at Finger Lakes. And then after that, you know, we just stayed in the game. You know, my original partners, all except one, are no longer involved. Two of them had passed away, unfortunately. And we just kept rolling along. We always have a lot of fun at Saratoga. That's the place that we, you know, hope that we can, you know, have our horses run and win a race up there, which is always tough. But, we look to buy horses that we're hoping can compete in a New York Stakes program. And if we're successful in doing that, that is really what we're looking to do. We have gotten extraordinarily fortunate, you know, with another first crop sire. I mean, and there are some real similarities here between Funny Side and Tis the Law in that regard. With Funny Side, it was the first crop sire Distorted Humor. With Tiz, it's the first crop sire of Constitution. And nobody knew that they were going to be star sires when we bought those horses. And look at what Constitution is doing now. So, you know, right time, right place. And here we are with a horse that, you know, we just don't know how far he could take us.
Jack, you're on top of the world right now. In a normal year, you'd have to stay on top of the world for 5 weeks. That's the distance between the Kentucky Derby and the Florida Derby. As you've already mentioned, this is a completely different animal, something nobody's ever seen before. You have 5+ months to go if, in fact, the Kentucky Derby is going to be run on September 5th. Knock on wood, it will. But how unnerving is that versus knowing in other years where you just have to keep him at a certain level for 5 weeks, get to the Derby, and if you get there, you should be able to run one heck of a race versus all the unknowns of having to wait till September?
Well, you know, we certainly would have preferred to be able to be going to the Derby in a little over 4 weeks. You know, I think, you know, given the fact that he is a horse that I would say matured early. I mean, he broke his maiden at Saratoga. He won the Champagne in October at Belmont and has followed up now with, you know, the two wins after getting beat in Louisville. He's primed. I mean, he is a horse that is ready to go a mile and a quarter the first Saturday in May. And what I think, you know, now will happen is that there are, you know, a lot of other horses, particularly some of the stables that Bob Baffert has, horses that, you know, will have the opportunity to do the maturing that I think Tiz has already done. And there are other horses that may well come back from injuries and things like that, Maxfield being one, Eight Rings being another. So I think that, you know, it's going to be much more challenging. You're probably going to have a much stronger field the first Saturday in September than you would have had in the first Saturday in May. On the other hand, you know, Barkley Tag, assistant Robin Smullen, they know how to train racehorses. And when they get a good one, they know what to do. Fortunately, you know, the two races that he's won down here in Florida, they've been off 8-week layoffs. So, you know, in the uncertain world that we're in, I call it a blank slate. We have no idea, you know, what race may be available for him to run next. In the ideal circumstance, we move the Travers to the beginning of August. That would be our prep for the real Kentucky Derby. And maybe a rescheduled Wood, something like that. So I'm only looking probably two races in all likelihood before the Kentucky Derby.
I just wanted to follow up on that because you said he's raring to go. He's ready to go a mile and a quarter right now on the first Saturday in May. What would the plan be to keep him, I guess, fit and enough that he can make that a push in the second half of the year? Would you consider sending him to the farm for a layup? Would you keep him in light training? What do you think you and Barkley will decide to do with him for these next couple of uncertain months?
Now, Barkley's a firm believer that you have the horse in a routine, you keep him in a routine. And I mean, it's worked perfectly, except for just a little bump in the road he had, you know, about 5 or 6 weeks ago, where he had a little bit of an issue with one of his hoofs after he threw a shoe. But other than that, I mean, after he won the Holy Bull, you know, we gave him a little lighter next couple of weeks. You know, didn't have to work him. And that's, you know, what I expect we'll do. But he's going to be with Barkley wherever Barkley is, you know, for the foreseeable future. Now we're looking at Palm Meadows. You know, nobody's sending horses into Belmont, which will be hopefully, you know, the next stop. But who knows? I mean, it could be, we could be down here and then ship directly into Saratoga. I mean, the world is so uncertain now that we don't know. But That's the plan. You know, he'll be with Barkley. Barkley's a big believer. Once horses are in a routine, keep them in a routine.
Jack, it's not up to you. It's not up to me. It's not up to Joe Bianca. But in a perfect world, what would you like to see them do with the Triple Crown spacing and the dates so far as how it might be play into your schedule? We don't know even if the Kentucky Derby is going to be the first race in the Triple Crown this year. It could even be the third. Look at it from two perspectives and maybe meld them into one. So far as what do you think makes the most sense and what would be best for your horse?
Well, I mean, if we didn't have the, you know, the crazy world that we're in, and you would be able to say, okay, all this is going to go away the end of April and then, you know, go back to normal life. At that point, I would love to see, you know, the Preakness sometime in May, late May. And I would love to see the Belmont like 4th of July weekend or the weekend before. Then we go to the Travers and we go to the Kentucky Derby. That would be, you know, the ideal from my standpoint. Now, you know, I don't believe that that's likely to happen. I think that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about trying to keep those races in order. So 2 weeks after, you know, the first Saturday in September comes the Preakness, and then, comes, you know, the Belmont. Maybe that's the way it has to be, given the uncertainty, you know, with the virus that we're fighting. But what that does, I think, unless you're a horse going for the Triple Crown, if you're a horse that thinks that, you know, you want to be in the Breeders' Cup, I think the Belmont's going to get left behind in that circumstance.
We're doing so much speculation here. I wanted to actually ask you about the Florida Derby because it was such a great win, especially with the uncertainty of the calendar coming up. One of the things I thought was really cool is that he previously would settle and make one run in most of his races. In this race, he was actually pressing the pace and kind of doing more of the dirty work and still had that same kick in the end. What were you thinking when you were watching the race? What was your reaction? I know you weren't able to be there, unfortunately, but how did you feel watching the race and afterwards?
Well, we had you know, talked to Manny and Barkley had, you know, said, you know, stay outside. You know, I think we know the horse well enough. You know the horse well enough, Manny. He likes to make that run. And, you know, let's not, you know, have to do what we did in the last race in the Holy Bull that impressed everybody so much, where you go backward a little bit to go out and then go forward again. So Manny gave him an absolutely perfect ride. And as I was watching it from my condo about a mile from Gulfstream, when they went into the third turn and he was sitting chilly out there, right then my confidence couldn't have been higher. I just said, you know, we're good. And, you know, he did most of it on his own. Manny, you know, gave him a couple of taps, you know, going down the stretch around the eighth pole or so. And then, you know, just kind of hand rode him the last 70 yards or so. So it was, you know, you couldn't have drawn it up any better. It was textbook fashion that we wanted to see, and Manny was able to achieve it for us.
All right, Jack, so thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations, obviously, on the victory, and good luck with them going forward. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank
great
you,
talking to you guys, and everybody stay safe.
All right, you too. Thanks, Jack.
Yep.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As the Green Group Guest of the Week, Jack Moulton will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. The Green Group tried to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com.
So that's going to do it for this week's episode of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland, the home of world-class racing and industry-leading sales. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Brian DiDonato, our producer Patty Wolf, our editors Anthony LaRocca and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you for tuning in. We will see you next week.